Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Normally when you're playing at a pool party or whatever, you'll play a game called Marco Polo. One person will yell, Marco, and all the people that they're trying to chase and find around in the pool while they're blindfolded will say, Polo. Truth is, play this game too, except one goes, Marco, and the other one goes, Passio. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, we have Marco Passio himself, the explorer of truth, on the show today. Mark, welcome to the program.
Vinny, it's great to be back on the show. Thanks so much for having me back on.
And I apologize, of course, opening with a terrible joke. What have you been what have you been up to lately, Mark? I know that the Free Your Mind conference and Bob Tuscan thingy, I had him on just a few days ago.
Sure, that's the main thing that's been going on, preparing for the Free Your Mind 3 conference coming up here near Philadelphia on April 10th, 11th, and 12th. It's going to be in Langhorne, Pennsylvania this year at the Sheraton Bucks County Hotel, and it's an all-star lineup of speakers, probably the biggest conference of its type in the entire United States this entire year, and it's just going to be a great event. People can check out the conference website at freeyourmindconference.com and check out all the speakers. I've been preparing for that, preparing my presentation for the conference. I'm going to be giving a presentation on the cult of ultimate evil, as I call it, order followers, order followers actually comprise a worldwide cult. People tend not to ever really think of it that way, but essentially they are following religious beliefs. They're following a religious belief system based on the blind belief in authority. And I'm going to try to explain to the audience at the Free Your Mind conference and for those who will watch later on video that what order followers worldwide actually constitute is a religious cult. So that's what I've been working on. I've also been working on editing a book and hopefully trying to get that out before the end of the year. So that's been going a little bit slow in going because writing isn't really my preferred medium. Most people know that I'm a much bigger fan of the spoken word, of course, you know, being a radio show host like yourself. But I've been working on that, getting it edited and trying to get it out there, and that'll be forthcoming soon. And, you know, just staying busy with my own radio show. I've been doing I just completed a series on the Second Amendment and the importance of gun ownership rights and breaking down the Second Amendment into its constituent components and explaining it in depth for people. So those are the things that have been keeping me busy of late.
I have a great deep admiration and respect for you because of this Free Your Mind conference in particular, where I think at least once you've been kind of noted by people as sort of like the best speaker there, and that was during the New Age BS presentation you gave. What you seem to do for people is almost opposite, but it's also complementary to what I do for people. I kind of generalize and summarize the important things that people need to know, but you kind of go in deeper for those who need to know more, the facts and the pressing details behind the general ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. I consider myself what I call an aggregator of information, bringing sources together from an eclectic variety of places and then, you know, kind of assembling the tapestry for people to see how it all fits together and works together, the big picture, you might say. And but I do also go into depth into the microcosm and really explore some details in depth and break things down over time, you know, just take my time with it and break down the details. So I think people appreciate both of those dynamics of the work that I put out because not only does it help them to realize the big picture, but they also gain a little bit of focused insight when it comes to particular topics.
And that is really important if you're going to be going out and arguing on behalf of anything. You see any number of people in videos talking these sort of incomplete sentences, not knowing the full truth behind what they're protesting about or why. And it is important if you're going to really, really do something about it or really start speaking about something to get quite a good chunk of background information, so you don't just fall flat on your face and make everybody go, ha ha, he's a conspiracy theorist and he can't back up his argument.
Exactly. You know, we have to bring the truth discovery methodology to the table, and that is assembling all of your varied sources of information first. You have to have, you know, what would be called your grammar correct first. You know, you're putting all of the disparate pieces of information on the table. Then you have to do your analysis. You have to weed through it, and you have to filter out any inconsistencies. And then after that, when you come to a conclusion about what it really means and you understand it, then you have to put it into practice. You have to actually act upon it. So, you know, these are the three steps of the Trivium process. These are the three steps of what I would simply call the methodology of truth discovery. And I think people need to bring that to the table when they're involved in research about what's really going on in the world.
Because what's really going on in the world is always a complex thing. It's never simple, is it, Mark?
Well, I would say it can be, like, the truth can be simple. It's not really easy to discover and act upon because we're blinded. So many people are blinded by distractions and blinded by mind control methodologies, and their own ego gets in the way a lot and can't allow them to admit that they're wrong about certain things, and therefore they don't want to see what is the actual reality that's taking place in their lives right before their eyes, because it's painful. You know, the truth can be very harsh. The truth can be ugly. And a lot of people don't want the associated responsibility that comes with understanding the truth, because when you do have a level of knowledge, with that goes personal responsibility to act and then do the right thing and to try to change things for the better. And most people don't want any part of that process. They would rather try to, you know, raise their hands and say, oh, I want to absolve myself of the responsibility to actually change things, to see what's wrong, to come to a conclusion about, you know, not only what the problem is, but what can be done about it solution-wise, and then actually become involved in that process and do it.
Mm. Knowledge is power, and with great power comes great responsibility. So if you want to start trekking down the path towards knowledge, you have to be aware that certain baggage will come with that, certain obligations.
That's right. And it means in many cases that you may not be able to you know, just live a selfish existence and live a life that you had planned for yourself. You know, the idea that, you know, life itself sometimes intervenes with our own personal selfish plans. And I think that's really the problem that humanity is facing right now. So few people want to get involved in the great work of changing this this reality that we are ensnared in, which is based in coercion and slavery, really. You know, it's based in the destruction of human freedom. And so many people look at that as such an overwhelming thing that, you know, that this whole complex of what can I do about it? And that, you know, sometimes stops them from even getting involved in the process of looking at what's going on and attempting to change it. But until we get more people involved in that great work, you know, situations don't just change on their own. There are specific requirements to change. And one of those main requirements is understanding the nature of the problem. So as you said, that knowledge is the very base step, the knowledge of what is going on, specifically what is going wrong, what is the nature of the problem. That is the very first step in making a diagnosis to try to understand how do you affect a solution to that problem that you seek to cure, to come to a solution for.
I really do have to make the point quite regularly about the people who say, don't tell us the problem, tell us the solutions. If you don't understand the problem, what solution could you ever possibly implement that'll work?
Exactly. That's like saying, I don't really know what's wrong with me, but tell me how I could become well if I'm sick. You know, you're not going to make a diagnosis first. You know, it doesn't make any sense. It's your logical processes would be completely out of order if you just think you're suddenly going to magically be cured. You know, there is a stepwise progression involved in this. And that's, again, so many people are uncomfortable with that because they want the easy answer. They want to be told everything's going to just magically work itself out and be okay without expending any real world effort and work and concentration and focus and actually becoming yourself directly involved, you know, and changing your own thoughts. That's one of the main solutions involved in this whole great work. You know, people want to think I can remain the same and somehow we can put a solution into effect that's going to solve everything. It doesn't work that way. When the mind changes internally, when our own thoughts, our own emotions, and our own actions change, then the external reality will change along with those things. But if those internal processes, those individuated processes don't change, if we don't change them by an act of our will, then the external reality just stays as the status quo. It stays in that situation of entropy and disorder and chaos and rapidly becomes worse and worse. When we change at an individual level, and that individual change goes outward to the aggregate, in other words, to the totality of the people, then we're going to see societal changes happen at a very rapid pace, but not just organically on their own without expending effort and willpower and taking in that knowledge of the nature of the problem first.
This reminds me of what I was thinking about just this morning, actually. First you say you don't care, and then you say, well, I don't know. And then you have to admit that you were wrong.
And therein lies the attachment to the ego. People not being able to admit that they are wrong. You know, a lot of people in the so-called New Age circles talk about ego death and the release from ego. But many people don't understand that what the ego really is, in a deep sense, that the negative aspect of the ego, I'm not just talking about being able to identify yourself as distinct or separate from another physical being. I'm talking about the attachment to the ego being the inability to admit that you are wrong about what is taking place. You know, people want to be right about everything, or they don't want to admit how bad something actually is. You know, they want to stay in that comfort zone where, again, it all goes back to personal responsibility. People don't want the responsibility of having to change something for themselves. They'd rather look to an external source of power and say, someone else will take care of that. And unfortunately, when we take that attitude on a wide scale, things remain the same and rapidly grow worse.
This reminds me of almost every YouTube comment I've ever received. You should be doing this that way instead of this way. It was like, excuse me, do you do anything at all other than sit exactly around watching other people's YouTube videos and poo-pooing them, and you're not creating or contributing?
I just can't imagine getting on a YouTube page and starting to just comment on other people's work and ask them to do things differently. You know, maybe say, hey, great job. I think good luck in reaching people with this information. Maybe that's about the maximum that I would ever do on a YouTube comment if I thought the work was good. But to get on a page and start complaining about somebody else's work and saying you're not doing enough or you need to do it this way is just, it boggles my imagination how anybody could think that that's an effective use of their time or energy. And it really does mean that people like that are part of the problem. You know, they're not, and you could look up their name, you know, just Google their name or something like that, and you'll notice that they have no work of their own at all. They never do. They just want something to complain about. They just want to nitpick at somebody else because they're doing absolutely nothing. That's all that really comes down to, Vinny.
It's like they're trying to bring me down to their level.
Right.
You know,
you have to just let that roll off your back like water off a duck's back. You know, that's you just can't get involved in, feeding the trolls, as they say. Trolls are going to troll, and, you know, just let them reveal themselves for what they are, which is useless.
Oh, just this morning, bro, I was just like trying to comment back to this guy, and I was like typing out something, and then I'd delete it, and then type it out again, and delete it, and then just go, wait, hold on a second, this is not worth my time. Block.
Right.
And the scum is gone.
Exactly. That's the best way of dealing with it.
I mean, look at it this way. There's an entire pool of humanity out there, and we're already exposing the worst of the worst. Do we need to interact with them too?
And, you know, the whole thing about, you know, nitpicking and infighting, you know, I can't believe there's that much of it in the alternative media community and in the so-called truth and freedom movements. It's like people don't really understand we have to unite on the common principles, which are the principles of self-ownership, non-aggression principle, the self-defense principle, natural law, the understanding of the objective reality of the difference between right and wrong behavior. You know, these are the basic principles that people need to come together and, you know, get on the same page on. And we could, you know, hash out the other little minutia differences later. You know, if we don't agree on those basic common sense principles regarding conscience and morality, we have no firm foundation to stand upon.
And if you don't have any foundation to stand upon, you're just going to get washed away by the waves of time, isn't it? And beyond measurement is the amount of civilizations that have fallen due to just basically not having any principles. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Right here on the Vinnie Eastwood Show, like Bob Marley says, we're jamming, and I hope you like peanut butter too. My very special guest is Mark Passio, also the brand of an incredibly soft brand of toilet paper down here in New Zealand, the Passio. Oh my God. Have I taken this down a little bit? I think I have. Anyway, we were talking over the break about watching films and the allegorical meanings between them. And two people can sit down and watch a film and see two entirely different films. One person would know about context and about history and about certain things that have happened, and then watch a film where references to those points of history are made and would actually find a very, very deep meaning within the film. Others would merely see a completely fictional action movie.
Exactly. I mean, people... many people don't understand what an allegory is. An allegory is an encoded piece of media, like a picture or a poem or a film or a story, that underneath the fiction, wrapped in the fiction, there is a deep spiritual lesson, a profound moral lesson. And the decoding requires a little bit of introspection. It requires looking at the film in a little bit of a deeper philosophical, from a deeper philosophical perspective. And that's what we were talking about during the break, that it's all a matter of perspective, of the consciousness of the one who is actually looking at that piece of media. And if their consciousness is high enough and they can see the patterns and they can try to understand what the author of that piece of media was intending to do allegorically, they'll be able to decode it quite effectively. I mean, you have movies like The Matrix, you have movies like They Live or Equilibrium, and they're profound spiritual allegories contained within them. Some people will be able to decode those allegories and come out the other end with profound moral and spiritual understanding, and some people will just see it as a science fiction film and, you know, and ascribe whatever entertainment value they will ascribe to it. But this doesn't take away from the fact that these are indeed allegories, and in many cases, the writers of such allegories really did deeply intend to put across a profound spiritual message that they wrapped in the fiction, instead of just coming out and try to say it directly philosophically to people, because that may be drier, or the message may not be received very well if it's presented directly, as you know many people do in the alternative media and the alternative research community. In fiction, it provides an opportunity to kind of bypass the conscious part of the mind and kind of nest of these ideas into the human subconscious part of the mind, which kind of acts as a fertile ground for that seed. And then down the road, when they may encounter, you know, some of these spiritual aspects in their lives at some future point, that seed may sprout and the person may organically develop from that allegorical implant, I guess you could say, into the subconscious, a conscious realization or understanding of that moral point that was trying to be made by the maker of the film or story or poem, etc.
One pattern I've noticed in the so-called truth movement, as you like to call it, is the propensity towards a sort of fandom towards superhero movies. In particular, of recent times, there's been the Batman franchise, to a lesser extent, the new Superman movie. But a lot of attention's been put into the Marvel Comics movie universe, which has been coming out and is not only proving exceptionally popular at the box office, but many people do derive these moral stories from a lot of these takes on the film universe.
Absolutely. I mean, like just in the break, for example, we were briefly discussing Captain America, the Winter Soldier. What I feel is an absolute allegory. It's pretty in your face. It's pretty blatant, actually. I think for people not to see it as an allegory about the destruction and the devastation of freedom that the military-industrial complex is wreaking upon the entire world and specifically upon America. There's also these historical little references in there, like they talk about the Nazis coming to the United States as part of Project Paperclip, and you know that became in the movie Hydra, which is just a thinly veiled allegory for the Nazi regime. And it's this idea that America is going to have to stand up for its real, original, true principles and combat this insidious, takeover by these political ideologies that are destructive to freedom and by the military-industrial complex. So that one, the Captain America Winter Soldier movie, is a pretty outward, not too veiled, very thinly veiled allegory. And most people, I think, can recognize something like that when they see it in the theaters. I don't think it takes too much decoding. Whereas, movies like The Matrix are, it requires a little bit more in-depth analysis and decoding of a lot of the spiritual tenets presented in a film like that that are pretty deeply veiled and encoded into the film.
I would say that if you simply use reversion, sort of like watching a movie in reverse psychology sort of thing, if you take everything that's real in the film and then apply it as an analogy to how the world outside really works here and now, then it seems to match up about how everybody's asleep and we're giving our energy to this big overall bunch of machine-like people and men. Just kind of like the Great Dictator speech by Charlie Chaplin when he says, exactly, we're not machines.
Exactly. And, people just have to start looking at these things in films and realizing that the makers of these movies are trying to put out a message. Most films have some type of allegorical content, and if you're going to go through that type of creative labor of love, most of the time people are going to want to put some type of a message into the film that is going to affect people at a deeper level. It's not always the case. I mean, some films are just for entertainment value, many films have allegorical content, and I think some people are coming to the realization more and more that when they go to some of these popular movies, these blockbuster movies, that the makers of the film and the studios in many cases have in mind to sway public opinion in one way or another. And I think that could be for very positive purposes, and there could be types of propaganda films and things that are put out there to sway people in the wrong direction. So discernment is also required when taking in things like this, not just to let it all sink in and go in unchallenged or unanalyzed or unfiltered, but you have to take into account, what is the actual message being delivered here, and look at it for what it's really worth, and see that this creative process is a way of, again, doing an end run around the conscious part of the mind and trying to slip a message in under the surface, where it can actually be quite effective, actually. That's why a lot of people who want to get a message out there prefer a fictional medium to wrap it in, because they know that it is an effective technique in planting messages in a mass audience.
You either need a fictional medium or a comedian.
That's another great way to do it, through comedy. And you're seeing a lot of comics, big comics in this regard come to mind, like Bill Hicks or George Carlin, et cetera. But you're seeing a lot of comics bring, content regarding what's going on in the world and into their comedy, politically, regarding freedom, et cetera. And that's an encouraging sign. I think also bands do it a lot through music as well. You see some bands bringing these type of topics into their lyrics and reaching their audiences that way with their message.
Well,
so
Mark,
art is a great way to spread a spiritual message.
Well, you've actually kind of hit on something here, because the very nonsensical mass-produced music for the teeny boppers, as well as the really crappy propaganda films, as well as the trash news, have actually also laid the path for the direct opposite use of that kind of medium.
Yeah, I mean, it can work both ways. It's a double-edged sword, for sure. There are what I would call alchemists that are working with these types of media, and there are sorcerers that are working with this type of media. Technology is a means to an end, and it doesn't necessarily mean that it's good or bad. The consciousness of the wielder is going to determine the outcome, ultimately. The technology is merely a tool.
I would ask you who these sorcerers are, but I know you're a journalist and you can't reveal your sorcerers.
Yeah, I mean, there's occultists throughout just about every major institution, and that includes Hollywood, that includes filmmaking, that includes writing, and again, people have to understand, one of the first things I tell people in the truth and freedom movements, so-called, is that being really conscious and truly awake means knowing about the occult and what it really is, meaning hidden knowledge, hidden information, and understanding that there are both positive and negative aspects to it. It's not all one thing. It's a very unpopular message. People don't like hearing that, because many people want to take a completely unidimensional mindset when it comes to that term. And that comes from religious thinking, mostly, which tells everybody, don't ever look into the information about the occult. It's all evil. It's all bad. And all occult means is hidden, from the Latin verb occultare in the Latin language. It means to hide or to conceal. So it's information that has been hidden for many different purposes, but the main one is to create a power differential between people who have that knowledge and those who are lacking it or remain ignorant of it. And that would be dark occultism. And then, there are valid reasons for occulting information, even for positive reasons, and it has been done in the past by people who wanted to preserve that knowledge because times were so bad and draconian, and their lives were such at risk that if they did not hide that information or conceal it temporarily, it could have been completely destroyed or lost for humanity entirely, or it could have fallen into the hands of people who would have used it for extremely negative and destructive purposes. So those are some of the reasons for the occultation of information regarding consciousness and regarding natural law. But now is the time for the great revealing. We're living, I call the times that we're living in, post-apocalyptic. We're not living in the apocalypse. The apocalypse has already occurred, and that's an odd thing for some people to hear, because they have a negative connotation of what apocalypse means. All apocalypse means is revealing. It means that you've removed the veil. You have de-occulted. You have unhidden what was previously veiled or hidden. And that has already occurred. The information that was occulted has been de-occulted. It has been broken out onto the world. It has been revealed. So we're living in a time where the truth is all out there. It's just a matter of, do people have the will to accept it and take it into themselves? And do they have the responsibility then to rightly act upon it, to do what is necessary to be done?
Well, I would think that WikiLeaks is half responsible for the apocalypse then.
Regarding some of the more dastardly deeds of government, I would say it has contributed to that revealing, sure.
Yeah, and aren't we all contributing to the apocalypse? And isn't this a great message to people? You too can contribute to causing an even bigger apocalypse.
Yeah, I mean, I look at that we're in almost post-apocalyptic times, because once it's all out there, you know, there's nothing really further for us to do except spread it around to understand it.
Maybe we can just kind of like hurry it along. Instead of a post-apocalypse, it'll be a FedEx apocalypse.
There you go. It can't happen too soon, as far as I'm concerned. I've been, you know, waiting for people to play catch-up for over a decade now. So I think more people have to get involved in that work that we've been doing and get this information out there to the people who are a little slow on the uptake, let's say.
Yeah. And just because somebody's slow on the uptake doesn't mean you should like stand over them and go, "You're slow on the uptake."
Sure.
It's more along the lines of, here's a hand, bro. Do you need a hand up? You know?
Sure.
I mean, for goodness sake, we're all kind of got the same wants, needs, and desires, whether or not we know it.
Without any doubt. And, you know, that's what the great work is really all about. It's about reaching out to other people. Us understanding the truth is the first step. And that's not the end. That's the very beginning. It's ultimately about reaching out to other people and helping them to go through the same transformative process that we've gone through.
Absolutely. Just like Optimus Prime. We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at the transformative Vinny Eastwood Show on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show, the show that knows that the times, they are a-changing. Bring on the apocalypse, I say. Lift that veil. Lift that veil like the 60s lifted miniskirt shirt length. Oh, yeah. Okay. That was a terrible reference. I don't even know where that came from. My very special guest is Mark Passio, coming at us live from Philadelphia. Now, everybody I talk to about Philly, Mark, has an affinity for Philly. You know, they just love it.
Really? That's pretty surprising. I mean, I don't really see Philadelphia as being such a you know, out in front city when it comes to human consciousness. But I guess it does have its historical context that kind of lends to its affinity. So I could kind of see that.
Well, I don't understand quite necessarily about the whole, there's just something about home, right? Wherever you spent the most time in, wherever you kind of like really enjoyed being, that seems to be home for some people.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't have any intention of going anywhere. I plan on staying in Philadelphia myself because, you know, this is where the founders of this country put their ideas out into the world from, and it's where the American Revolution was birthed. So I think that it's going to be a place that is going to need to be a place where we make a stand during the time that is going to determine whether humanity is going to sink or swim and be free or be enslaved. I think it's going to kind of, as they say, historical patterns tend to repeat themselves. And I think Philadelphia is going to play an important role in what is to come regarding that dynamic.
Do you believe that locations hold certain energies of things that occurred there during their past? And I say this because when I went to the police cells and the courthouse down in Dunedin, mm-hmm. these big stone buildings, that kind of thing, it felt horrific in there.
I absolutely do. And people may be surprised to hear that kind of a belief come out of me, but I have felt it myself. So it's something that comes from what I consider direct experience. And the place that I felt it most viscerally was at Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. And when I was at Valley Forge the last couple of times, the palpable and tangible energy coming from that place, you know, and regarding, of course, what happened there, a lot of the battles of the American Revolution, key battles in the American Revolution, and the people that shed their blood and died there, you know, for, you know, moving this country forward and out of the grip of the, you know, the English and British Empire. I think that it definitely, that area definitely holds an energy of the people that made the ultimate sacrifice there. And the last few times that I was there, I felt it, and it was foreboding. It was dark. I felt as if some of the spiritual energy there was quite upset with the way things are going down and taking place in this country in the modern day. And it was almost as if some of those souls were crying out. And it felt very uncomfortable. And I almost kind of want to avoid that place in the future because of the kind of reaction that I had toward that energy the last time that I was present there. Maybe I could give it another chance and, you know, go check it out again. But again, the answer to your question there ultimately is yes, I absolutely believe that places can hold the energy of the events that occurred there in the past and possibly even energy of the souls that were present there in the past, for sure.
So in such a way, Philly does have that that sort of soul, as it were, of revolution.
I think there are certain places within it that do. You know, I think you can feel that as you walk in the old city area, the place where, you know, which was like the original core of the city, and, you know, around the place where the Declaration of Independence was signed, of course, at Independence Hall. I think that area is pretty strong with that type of energy, myself, at least in walking in that region and, you know, passing around those areas of the city. I feel something different in those areas. So, yeah, I think that is still present in the city. And maybe that is, I would assume that is the reason for many people's affinity with Philadelphia, should they have a strong affinity with the city. It's probably the reason that I have a like for the city, not so much the modern dynamic of it, of what it holds culturally or with the people that are here now. But and I'm not trying to put down everybody that is from Philadelphia. I'm just saying as a general level of consciousness, you know, it could be doing better, but so could most places in the world. So that's not really that much different than anywhere else. But I can understand why, at least from a historical perspective, why people would have an affinity for the city of Philadelphia because of what happened here in the past.
Well, I just say that because I've been thinking about a whole lot of people moving around New Zealand, and many people I've been talking to in the States moving to other areas for certain reasons. Some tend to be very successful, and they're like, wow, I found exactly what I'm looking for, while others are very disillusioned with what they find when they move into a place and go home, you know? And I was just thinking about this. I'm living in Auckland specifically because I've got super fast broadband accessible here, and it's like 15 to 20 minutes to the main protest sites and within an hour's drive to the second main centre. So I think that it's about my work is where I live, that kind of thing. Sure. And this is where the jobs are. And ultimately, if you're exposing scumbaggery for a job, it's pretty safe employment.
Yeah, I think, you know, our consciousness will lead us to where we need to be. And I think when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, and you're, you know, doing the work, and you're reaching people, the universe will put you in the place that you need to be. I think we're exactly where we need to be respectively right now.
Well, everybody contributes in their own way from their own place, and as long as they're contributing to the whole, you can't really fault them, as long as they're not doing nothing.
Exactly. I mean, it's about getting involved on the spiritual battlefield, as I like to call it. You know, it's about taking right action and working with other people. It's not about silence and just saying, I know, so I'm okay. That's, I think, one of the worst places that anybody could be in. And unfortunately, I think that's what a lot of alternative spiritualities try to teach to people, to say, oh, just work on yourself. Working on yourself is vitally important, and that absolutely needs to be done first and foremost. But once you've done that work, and I'm not saying it's ever completely finished or done and absolutely over, that's always a perpetual, continual process, because no one is perfect, and we could all improve upon ourselves in some way or form. But once you've gotten the knowledge of what's taking place and the root of the problem in consciousness, and you understand that we're living in a system of slavery, and that needs to change, and that system needs to go away, and real freedom needs to be born in this world, and that comes from moving into a higher level of awareness, then you being transformed is, again, the very initial part of the work. Then the work has to move into, we have to look around and say, what is the aggregate consciousness here? You know, where are other people at? Because we're not the only ones here. There are others around us who are still in those lower states of consciousness and suffering as a result. Then you have to work at being an influence to change those minds, those individuated consciousnesses that are around us and part of us. They're not separate from us. You know, it's we are one in a true sense, that as the aggregate consciousness and the aggregate morality goes, so the aggregate state of freedom or enslavement goes. I word this in my natural law material as the law of freedom. In the aggregate sense, as morality increases amongst the population, the freedom of that population increases. And in the aggregate sense, as the morality of any given population decreases and becomes more immoral, the freedom of that population wanes and declines, and that population becomes more enslaved. It's a very simple mathematical equation. Freedom is proportional to morality, and vice versa. Morality is proportional to freedom. As morality increases, freedom increases. As morality wanes or declines, freedom declines.
That's right, because people who don't have any morality don't like people who've got freedom. In general, I mean, and once they seize control of the power structures of society, you know, business, law, politics, right, entertainment, right, then they've basically holding all the draw cards. They can finance and destroy anything that they want. And everybody else more or less has to get with the program or overthrow them and almost sacrifice everything that you'd ever want in your life. You'd want freedom, you'd want your prosperity and everything, but in order to get it, you have to have tyranny and you have to have scumbaggery. Mark Passio has been my very special guest. Thank you very much. WhatOnEarthIsHappening.com is his website. We'll be right back. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're just having a few technical difficulties trying to get our guest connected, Richard Gage. Okay, so I remember when Richard Gage came to New Zealand and he did his three-hour presentation, The Architecture of Destruction. And I had this really interesting sensation. I would say it was a moment of inspiration, where you can see somebody with a lot of credibility, a lot of skills, etc., being able to relay to an audience in a very, very simple fashion how the Twin Towers and Building 7 were not just destroyed by planes and collapsing floors and what have you, but something slightly more exotic: controlled demolition. Now, I know that this is a staple knowledge base for most people, but ultimately, when we're talking about controlled demolition, you could probably better get an architect or an engineer to explain to you how it went down, don't you think? And here he is now, Richard Gage. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's awesome to be here, Vinny.
I am so glad to have you here. Nearly had myself a talk radio heart attack.
Uh-oh.
Don't worry. I'm a professional. I'll manage. I'll pump myself up with adrenaline or something of that nature. I've got a needle around here somewhere. Anyway, I would like to actually get a little bit of your personal backstory, not so much of the the controlled demolition, which listeners are fairly familiar with. But you personally, looking at 9/11, did it change you? And if it did, how did it change your life?
Yeah, it changed me. I was a Reagan Republican, rooting for the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I wanted to go get those bastards, and completely taken in by the Fox News, I guess, and Colin Powell making his irrefutable case for weapons of mass destruction against Saddam Hussein and ties to Osama bin Laden. I mean, that's the flag-waving Republican that got 8 years ago quite a turnaround when I found the evidence for the explosion of all three World Trade Center skyscrapers on 9/11. And I'm going, well, how could this be? We would have heard about it. This is impossible. We'd heard about it in the left media, the liberal media, or the conservative media. Somebody would have reported all of this overwhelming evidence for the explosive demolition of not two skyscrapers, but this third one, Building 7, which came down at free fall acceleration straight down into its own footprint, a 47-story skyscraper not hit by an airplane in the perfect manner of a classic controlled demolition. And they told us, architects and engineers, that it came down due to normal office fires. But most of us didn't even know about the building coming down, much less the lies that we were told by the government and media and our own American Institute of Architects about it. So when I show people this building, and I go all around the world in 400 presentations, and we're about to go to Europe in 2 weeks in 10 countries and 20 presentations in 40 days, and we're going to show them. When they see it, by a show of hands, they all agree overwhelmingly with the evidence. So, yes, like them, their worlds will change. My world changed. I had to face squarely the implications of this evidence, and that was very hard for me because I couldn't believe that some sort of inside operation was responsible for such a massive deception upon the American people and me, that could say that they could convince us that these buildings came down due to jet plane and jet fuel fires and weakening the steel and coming down at the Twin Towers in just under 12 seconds, each of these towers completely shattered, top to bottom, missing 110 floors at the bottom, pulverized to concrete, 90,000 tons in midair, with evidence of nanothermite, thermite incendiaries, molten iron at 2,800 degrees that jet fuel and normal office fires can't even get. This kind of evidence, which is so solid and so overwhelming, blew me away. And I said, I can't just, like, go on with my job. I mean, I had a great job. I was earning $100,000 a year as an architect, solving large problems on large projects, like a $400 million project in Nevada with 1,200 tons of square of steel framing that's fireproofed. I lost that job. I just had to give it up because I was so busy traveling around the country trying to wake up my fellow architects and engineers. So we started out with one architect and engineer for 9/11 Truth. Now we have 2,300 because I went to the 14-person architecture firm that I was working at, and I brought pizza to the conference room. Finally, I had to get these guys to see this information, because up until then, for a couple of months, I'd been telling them about this, but they didn't believe me. They thought I was nuts. So I put the presentation together, stealing most of the slides from Stephen Jones, and with his permission, ultimately. And they were all convinced. Every one of them were convinced these are controlled demolitions. They were blown away like I was. They signed a petition. That was my first 14 architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. Except for my boss, he didn't sign it because he was Middle Eastern and very, very concerned, you know, at the time. And still today, Middle Easterners are targeted, and they're very concerned for their own careers and their safety. Because the other thing that concerned me so much that I didn't know about was the Military Commissions Act, the National Defense Authorization Act came later in 2012, and the Patriot Act all take away our First and Fourth Amendment rights. Any of us can be arrested today without charge, without even a right to a trial or a lawyer, we could be held indefinitely and disappeared is what we're talking about. This is a fascist country or a communist country, anything but the democracy that our forefathers fought for. So I knew that my life was going to change. I knew that I have to go 9/11 Truth full time until every American has the opportunity to hear this information and act on it. And I've been kind of disappointed that a lot of people don't act on it even after seeing the information, because they just have too much fear or apathy. It's like one or the other.
It's
people confront this evidence.
It's like in a courtroom how you're trying to go beyond reasonable doubt. Some people have completely unreasonable doubts. Meaning,
explain that.
They doubt the validity of your evidence, and that's completely unreasonable.
Especially before they see it, they'll hand wave it off as a conspiracy theory, something like that. They won't even look, most of them, at the evidence when they become aware that it is being offered to them. Then some of them indeed will see it, and a few of them will actually find a way to justify. They say the stupidest things, like physicists even will say, of course a building can come down at free fall acceleration. It's mostly air after all, you know, ignoring the 40,000 tons of structural steel that's five times stronger than it needed to be to hold building 7 up in the air 47 stories for its life and for 100 years. But all of a sudden, 80 of those columns are completely compromised all at once, which is what has to happen in order for the building to come down suddenly, symmetrically, at free fall acceleration. That's the only way. And guess what? The few small office fires in that building that NIST blames for its collapse cannot possibly cut 80 columns all at once like a controlled demolition. So everybody gets it once they see it. The question is, are they going to do something about it? And, of course, a lot of them do. 2,300 of them have signed our petition, and 50 of them signed a resolution that's going before the AIA board at the AIA conference, American Institute of Architects, in May in Atlanta, where we will arrive after our Europe tour and push the issue very hard on the floor of the conference.
One argument that I see a lot in order to rebuke this is saying that there's no evidence, we would have seen it, it would be out there or something like that. I took 2 seconds and just Googled 9/11 conspiracy and got 25,400,000 results in two seconds. And you're saying, oh, there's no evidence. There's no evidence anywhere. Look, you could just do an image search and there's thousands upon thousands of people's memes with all the free fall acceleration speeds and the evidence for nanothermite and pictures of the cut beams and everything. Even at a minor glance, one could get the clear impression that there's something wrong with 9/11 simply by searching for it in the first place. But people fear searching for it in the first place because of the ramifications. And I believe that's a perfectly logical fear, because now you know, and you cannot escape the truth, that your government or people within the government might kill their own citizens and or cover up the deaths of them and prevent bringing the people responsible to justice, and will use you as a pawn to justify other agendas, which are inherently anti-American, anti-freedom, and in some ways anti-human.
we're quite concerned about the next 9/11. I mean, what we're being called to do by this evidence, which is how I conclude my presentation, is asking people, when, at what point do you draw your personal line in the sand and say, thus far and no farther? You know, do you wait for the next 9/11, which is coming? And it's a huge concern of those of us in the 9/11 truth movement who are exposing the last one. The next one's predicted by members of Congress and the media to be far worse than the last.
But of course, that's what they've said all along, to scare people into accepting their agenda, Richard.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an agenda of fear. Yeah, that's what it is. And you go from all of the basic shootings that we've had to the ISIS terrorism scare. A lot of these things are manufactured and laid on as false flag operations, just like 9/11.
Indeed. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Richard Gaides from Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is a very interesting day, and I am privileged to have had, and still having, of course, two very remarkable guests on the show today. Earlier we had Mark Passio, which me and my current guest Richard Gaides were talking about over the break. And it's kind of like an interesting world, isn't it? There's so much truth out there that you can take almost any path towards it. It's just a question of whether or not you want to reach it, you know? How long is that path going to go for? How many stumbles do you have to have along the way? How much pain and self-sacrifice to relieve others of their ignorance must you exude in order to make a difference, in order to feel right? Sometimes you'll question yourself, ladies and gentlemen. You'll think, should I quit my job and just devote myself full-time into exposing some form of scumbaggery? And the answer I can give you is, does it feel right? If it feels right, you're probably going to have to do it sooner or later. As Richard did, as I did, as so many others in this entire movement who have dedicated their lives to exposing mistruths and bringing the real truth out. Richard, welcome back. Are you there, Richard? Oh, no. He's dropped out, son. It's happening again. You got to be kidding me, bro. AFR, you managed to get it sorted last time. Maybe it's a little change of the switcheroony. Messing it round. But regardless, I've noticed that I use a hell of a lot of analogies. Really? I do, don't I? And it's quite terrible, ultimately, because it smacks of some lack of information. Here, Richard, you're back. Oh,
sorry about that.
Yeah.
Hit the wrong button.
Yeah, it happens that time. Okay, so I was talking about people quitting their jobs and devoting themselves full-time into spreading the truth about whichever topic they happen to be involved in, as you've done, as I've done. And just going to say the question you ask yourself before you're doing that is, does it feel right?
To me, it feels like there's nothing else that I can do. My country is at stake. Not at stake. It's deeply threatened. It's more than at stake. It's been taken. If 9/11 happened to us, and if it was, the three controlled demolitions, then somebody did that. And that somebody is deep into the American government, and those people are wide, and the spectrum of control they would have to have over the media to keep it from being well known. The censorship level's incredible. And for instance, regarding that, I didn't know that 90% of our mainstream media in the United States is controlled by just six corporations. And I found out that those corporations are in turn controlled by the same people who control companies, corporations in the arms industry, the oil industry, the banking industry, the insurance industry, all these who profited enormously from the events following 9/11. So we've got plenty of reason to be extremely concerned about our own freedom from these corporations, who's ever running them and who's ever running those people. So I could do nothing else. I have to go full time. I mean, every American is being called, every patriot. You don't have to wave the flag. That's what they do when they want to go to war. But this is an information war to wake up the hearts and minds of the American people to those people who are trying to manipulate all of us in these endless wars, in this control grid, with these false flag operations to manipulate us. I'm not having any more of it. So I've got no choice. We now have 20,000 people signed on to our petition, in addition to the 2,300 architects and engineers. And there's millions of people in the 9/11 truth movement who are using our materials to spread the information, the evidence, far and wide.
It's like everybody's sort of playing their part or whatever. It's like a game of football, really. It's a team effort. Can't do everything by yourself, but if you've got a team behind you, mate, you can score. And have we had some big scores, Richard? Have some things come out that wouldn't have come out otherwise without work of people like yourself?
We have made some inroads into mainstream media. Geraldo Rivera had Building 7 showing, only the third time it's been on mainstream media, dropping like a rock in front of God and everybody. Everybody could see that it was a controlled demolition. We had one of our engineers, Tony Zambodi, on, and one of the 9/11 family members supporting the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth and the entire 9/11 Truth movement. That was Bob McIlvain. And there Geraldo is saying, basically, it sure looks like a controlled demolition to me. They know a lot more than I do. Thank God. Then on C-SPAN in August, we got a 45-minute interview on Washington Journal TV program. And that is where the congressmen, senators are interviewed for their in-depth information that goes out to the American people. We had 3 million people watching Building 7 going down on that show. And now that interview is their number one viewed video at Washington Journal. It's incredible. Just last week it came up to that status. So we're asking them to...
Are we talking about of all time?
Yeah, on that program of all time. Washington Journal. They have thousands and thousands of interviews.
Whoa.
That they've done. Every day they do several. So, or at least a couple every day. So, this is an incredible opportunity. Millions and millions of people have seen it. So we're very grateful for these minor breakthroughs. On the other hand, YouTube took down a video that we had, which had 1.5 million views, which they took down citing it's either spam or commercially deceptive content or something like that, but they wouldn't be specific and they wouldn't respond to our legal efforts to get them to restore it or tell us exactly why they took it down.
How long ago did that happen?
That was 3 weeks ago.
Well, the exact same thing happened to me when I made a 6-minute video exposing the Federal Reserve banking history of our current Prime Minister, who was up for election. And 2 weeks before the election, my YouTube channel was taken down with that exact same non-specific message. And then 2 months later, on November the 5th, remember, it got restored, saying, well, it wasn't all these nonsensical things. No, sorry, but at least I got my channel back, so it'll probably happen to you in about a month and a week's time.
But did they restore the number of views that you had up to that time?
Yes, they did. It happened in stages. First, the channel gets restored, and it looks like all the videos have zero views. But then the next day, all the view counters got restored back up. And then I think the next day, all the old comments and likes and dislikes and all of that general data got picked back up again. So it was quite a relief. And unless they've actually got just cause to take down your channel, like have you actually done something wrong? If you've dotted your I's and crossed your T's, they will give it back to you. But it runs on an automatic algorithm that just goes automatically, hey, a whole bunch of people have complained about this. They may have falsely complained, and they might get their punishment by YouTube in due course. But ultimately what means is when you get your channel back, it'll be even harder to take down next time because YouTube will remember that you get false complaints trying to take your channel down.
What do you mean false complaints for taking your channel down?
Well, let's say, for example, I'm somebody who doesn't believe 9/11 is a false flag event. And so I inappropriately flag your video as spam. And then that little complaint gets sent away to YouTube. YouTube algorithm analyzes it and just for safety's sake, takes down your channel or your video.
Yep.
And then they review it over 2 months. And then bring it back if there was nothing wrong.
2 months down, though. That's incredible.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, we have thousands of links out there to the Ed Asner narrated WTC7 15-minute video that 1.5 million people have seen. And it has very few negative comments just from debunkers and stuff. And they can just destroy the truth movement this way. And there's no panel. Arbiters or appeal board that you can go to, and you can't even talk to these people. You wait an hour on the line. We're very upset anyway right now about this. It's a big deal because this is going viral.
I know exactly how you feel. I had 3,000 videos, and it was in the middle of election season, and I'm kind of like the only channel in New Zealand exposing the truth about the scumbaggery of the New Zealand political parties. So I lay face down on the floor for a couple of minutes, because it's like losing a loved one or something very, very important in your life, and I feel for you, Richard, I really do.
Yeah, and this is just a big corporation without a name, without a face, you know, without a door you can walk in and talk to somebody. At least in the U.S. government, you know, there's people you can talk to, and there's appeal systems that have that are responsive. So I'm glad you had the experience you did on YouTube. We have not had that experience, it's just completely unjust. I did come down to New Zealand in 2009, I think it was. Did I see you in Christchurch?
In Auckland, I filmed your presentation. It's up on my YouTube channel. That got taken down at the same time, too.
Okay. Yeah, so people can see our Auckland presentation in 2009 on your channel. Or is it back up?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like I said, on the 5th of November, Guy Fawkes Day, everything got totally restored. But anyway, enough with the technical issues of the truth movement, because we only have a few minutes left in the broadcast. You have a few talks coming up in the UK, don't you, Richard?
Yeah, it's very exciting. We will be in Europe starting in Iceland on the 13th of April 13th. Then we go to Denmark and then Amsterdam and then Berlin. And then we roll into the UK. We'll be in London and Bristol and what's it called? Froome. And exciting.
Did you say Foom?
Froome, F-R-O-M-E. They pronounce it Froome.
They actually have a place called Froome? Do they have good Starbucks there?
It's a city. I don't know what kind of Starbucks they might have there.
Extra Froome on top.
I'm excited. What is Froome? Is that a New Zealand term?
I have no idea what Froome is. It just sounds really interesting. It sounds like a frosty room.
That's great. So, yeah, we'll be throughout the UK. Then we roll into Paris. I'm bringing up the schedule here, but it's like the 1st or 2nd of May. Then we roll on to Grenoble on the other side of France and into Switzerland. And then Vienna, and no, then we go down to Rome. 89 Truth has not been to Rome before. And then we come back to Budapest. We haven't been in Eastern Europe at all. So that's on the 12th of May in Budapest. And then we go straight to the AIA convention, American Institute of Architects, May 14th through the 16th in Atlanta, where we will be supporting this resolution that I mentioned. So that's 45 days on the road for me. That's the longest we've been on the road. Pretty exciting.
Is it kind of like being an exhausted rock star? Like I heard that rock stars, they have to sing like almost every other night, right? So they actually have to start spraying their throat with steroids in order to be able to keep doing it. You have to take any extreme measures to keep up the yapper with the 3-hour presentations every day or two?
I did just tour Pennsylvania with 3 presentations in a row, and I did have a problem. I don't know what it was really about, but I didn't know about steroids, but I might check into that for my throat because it was quite a problem, the third event there. Yeah. But I don't
think you can have vocal steroid users for 9/11 Truth.
I miss out on the partying and the groupies, but other than that, yeah, it's a lot of hard work.
Indeed. Richard Gage, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on the show, and we will see you again sometime. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back after the break. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the final segment here. I wanted to give people a little bit of a brief update about my documentary making. I've managed to get the computer sorted, so that's all good. We can finally start editing the thing. However, I still don't have the camera sorted. So, yeah, it's a little bit of a frustrating delay system in terms of starting principal photography. And if I can't make it work, then I'll just use the other two far crappier cameras that I have to get the job done by the alleged time frame of July the 4th. So that'd be cutting together a full 90-minute documentary with dozens and dozens of interviewees and scripting and the whole works in 3 or 4 months, give or take. That's a lot of pressure. I'm wanting to make it an actual good document. It's not going to be like my audio archives where it's just like a couple of pictures or whatever. Like something actually really awesome. Something that really grabs the attention. Something that's actually looked like a lot of effort's been put into it. So I'll probably have to work 3-4 times as hard as any documentary filmmaker known to man in order to bring it in by the allotted time frame. And it will be done, I hope. And if not, I'm going to apologize massively and profusely and claim technical difficulties. But anyway, in terms of what the documentary is about, it's about like everything, man. Really. So many documentaries have been made over the years by people that have taken one element, one subject, one instance in history and have expanded on it ad infinitum so that the facts and details are clear via a logical documentary format. What I believe is necessary now, and the reason why I'm planning to make this thing, is because I have yet to see somebody take all of the very important elements of our current understanding of how the world works and the expansive experience and information from people who are leaders in the scumbaggery exposing industry, we'll just call them that, is basically too much to really digest all together. So, going to compress it. Going to chop it down. Going to be bullet points. It's going to be really intense information packed into as small a possible groove as even humanly possible. That's the gift that I have sometimes, a lot of the time, is summarizing things without leaving out the details. So just think about this. International banking and derivatives markets. Big, big topic. Think about the blind trusts. Okay, the politicians will swindle money out of a place like Ireland, like John Key did, and then pop all the money into blind trusts so that nobody can really search them or tell what's in them, including them, you know, allegedly, except they just create another trust that has similar holdings, and they'll know how each of them is doing by looking at that one that they do control that isn't blind. Think about derivatives. There's quadrillions of dollars of derivatives in debt out there, and the bankers are just making up more money, getting everybody's country even more in debt by the day. It's something ridiculous that New Zealand was loaning like $1 million a week. That sounds ridiculously small. More like $300 or $400 million a week. It might have even been per freaking day for all I know. It's like well over like $97 billion, and that was of a couple of weeks ago, so it's probably over $100 billion now. We only got 4 million people here. And that's plus $112 billion worth of freaking derivatives that were reported on in 2011 and not since, so they're probably 10 times, 30 times, 100 times. Goodness knows how big they are now. We're going to have 4 million people collectively owing hundreds of billions of dollars. That's like 60 grand each per man, woman, and child or some crap like that. This is how big the problem is. These are the things you need to know about how the system works. Straightforward, just like that, showing the enormity of the problem. We're slaves now on the land that our forefathers settled in. Right? And that's exactly what the Founding Fathers warned of. Private banks controlling the issuance of currency. You're going to wake up homeless. And some people throughout history have really, really tried to expose this kind of thing. Presidents like Andrew Jackson, who was trying to destroy the private bank that was being set up in his day. Somebody tried to kill him. They had two single-shot pistols, broad daylight. Both of them misfired. Isn't that interesting? On his deathbed, Andrew Jackson was asked what his greatest achievement in life was. He exclaimed, "I killed the bank!" This is kind of the sort of resistance and anger that you need to have against ruthless criminals sometimes in order to repel them from parasitingly taking over your freaking nation with their debt that they can create out of thin air. Think about Jekyll Island. I'm going to be interviewing G. Edward Griffin about this, the author of the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, where the Federal Reserve began, and the 1913 passage of the Federal Reserve Act and the IRS, which was conducted on Christmas when barely anybody was in Congress. Apart from a few paid-off representatives of the banking cartel, of course. That's how they get you. Watch for the holiday seasons, because that's just when you turn away. Just when you think you can have a day off, just when you think you can enjoy your life with your family, they'll pass something that'll ensure your family becomes slaves forever. Beautiful, isn't it? If you're a ruthless criminal sociopathic scumbag, with no empathy, no cause for the common good. Similar BS happens here in New Zealand, and we're going to be having Ian Parker on to talk about that. Because the documentary has to really do not only with how it happens in the center, the milky nuggety nougat of the United States when it comes to scumbaggery. All right, scum have infected this planet, and their main parasitical approach is in the United States. Seems to be that's when the majority of the money seems to be getting made up out of thin air, and what have you. So it is important that America be used as an example of what these scumbags do to a country, and then relay that information via similar examples with what's happening in your own nation, here in New Zealand. But of course, if America's not involved in any kind of resistance to this agenda, the world is lost, in my opinion. Last country on earth with like widespread gun ownership, Virch. Maybe apart from South Africa, which is in chaos. last place where people are so well armed that they could actually mount a resistance against a tyrannical government, if one were so inclined. Unlimited debt means bankers will eventually own everything. Okay? It's mathematically certain. Game of musical chairs. The bankers are the only ones who don't have to get up off their chair to dance around, so that when everybody else is dancing around and a chair gets pulled out, the banker's never dancing around with them. He's always sitting in his chair, raking in the music. We're already debt slaves. Get any group of people together and ask them to raise their hands if you've got debt. No, nobody's not going to raise their hand unless they're lying. We've got credit card debt, mortgages, personal loans, higher purchases. And if it's not debt that we owe already, it's some kind of utility bill that we haven't paid off yet. Or one that's coming that we don't have the money to pay. You see how it works? It's all-encompassing. I mean, usury. Using money and making somebody else live their life basically to pay that money back plus interest, so that they virtually don't really end up with any money at all. Why do you think Muslims in the Muslim countries have outlawed usury? Okay, there's a reason for that. Because it breeds scumbaggery. Large quantities of it. And as mentioned before, the bankers will wind up owning everything. Certain cultures have a different approach to this, like for example, outlawing it. But I believe that in our day and age, these sort of elements of the conspiracy not only need to be explained, but they need to be made relevant to people. And they need to be explained in such a simple fashion that even the simplest of people can understand it. That is truly the objective here with this documentary. And we're not just talking about banking either. Secret societies, the powerful round table groups, the UN, climate change, Agenda 21, how toxic our environment is, how corruption and how criminals can get in charge of the state and keep running them, how the intelligence community smuggles drugs and pays for black ops with the profits, how people get assassinated, false flag terrorism. All these kind of things really do need to be expanded on and encapsulated for people, and I really hope to do that. So I wish for people to help me with that by donating at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com through the PayPal there or anything. Please send me a message if it's specifically for the documentary. We're trying to raise $4,000 still to pay off the current computer, which has proved to be very, very amazing in doing its job. So thank you very much for listening. We'll see you again sometime, folks.